I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. In conversation, this time, around the idea of music as a window on the history of the 20th century. A century of modernism, totalitarianism, world war, and globalization. Our guest, Alex Ross, is the music critic of the New Yorker magazine. He's written a great novelistic feast of a book with the title The Rest is Noise. My bumper sticker version of one long thread in the book would be something like how the headquarters of musical composition moved in the 20th century from Vienna to Los Angeles, from the old home address of Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, and Mahler, to the new home in or around Hollywood of the refugee modernists Stravinsky and Schoenberg, and of course, the movie business that put wonderful composers like Bernard Herrmann to work writing theme music like what we're hearing here from the Hitchcock thriller Vertigo. Alex Ross, when you hear Vertigo now, Jimmy Stewart on the roof in San Francisco, what do you hear as a fragment of the history of the century?
Well, first of all, you know, these dissonant chords that appear at the beginning of Vertigo, you know, in terms of harmony, we're no longer on home base. We're out somewhere in the ether of this strange, foreboding atmosphere. You know, these sounds originated toward the beginning of the 20th century with composers like Arnold Schoenberg in Vienna and Igor Stravinsky coming from St. Petersburg to Paris. And, you know, at first they were scandalous. They were alien. Audiences ran away in terror. But within a decade or two, they were seeping into the mainstream. And one way in which so many people got to know these sounds was through movie soundtracks. And Hollywood composers found these strange new chords very useful for setting the dramatic atmosphere for movies such as the Hitchcock thrillers. And Bernard Herrmann was an amazingly gifted composer who was from New York. Orson Welles first brought him out to Hollywood to do the music for Citizen Kane and for Magnificent Ambersons. And Hitchcock later took him up, and this great collaboration began that included Vertigo and North by Northwest and Psycho and several other amazing films. And Hitchcock knew exactly what he was doing in terms of bringing Herrmann into his employ. He was not a routine composer. He was constantly innovating in terms of how he treated the orchestra. He had his own signature sound. You can really recognize a Herrmann score after just a few bars. And this is not the case with many other film composers who tend to be more imitative. So he was a real original. And the great disappointment for him in his life was that his great successes came in film and not in concert music and opera. And he had great ambitions in that area that were never entirely fulfilled. But I think the music for Vertigo, it's one of the dramatic masterpieces of the century, never mind the fact that it's a film score. I mean, this is incredibly powerful music that makes this whole movie in a lot of ways.
No question. And we can hear it now. We can hear sort of the miracle of Alfred Hitchcock, Mr. Suspense, putting this kind of music brilliantly to work for his purposes. You say he knew what he was doing, but what was it he knew? And where did these guys locate themselves on what is always too simple a division between serious music and pop entertainment?
Yeah, well, I mean, the film composers were always falling somewhere in the middle. And, you know, very often if someone went to Hollywood and wrote a few scores, colleagues in classical music would start to look down on him and, you know, he's sold out, he's just sort of doing mere commercial work. You know, and yet it's not really mainstream pop music because it's still very much in the classical tradition. So they were in this neither here nor there position. And still today, you hear people talking about, oh, that just sounds like film music. That's mere film music. But you know, there are great film score compositions by Takamitsu in Japan and Herman, and Aaron Copland went to Hollywood and wrote some wonderful film scores. So it is an area that should be taken more seriously, I think.
Every time I see On the Waterfront, I marvel again at Leonard Bernstein's score for that. I mean, that's part of the movie. We're going to talk with Osvaldo Golihov, whose music, and I heard a great deal of it last weekend, sounds like, you know, we're waiting for the movie. And it's not a put-down of either the movies or of the music. I mean, maybe this was the secret to locate in a booming industry that had a huge popular root but also demanded a complete talent and a historical mastery.
Yeah, of course, the thing to say about the film studios is in the 1930s and 40s, they gave employment to a lot of wonderful musicians and composers who had been driven out of Central Europe by the rise of Hitler, and these people were suddenly homeless, and the studios offered them a refuge and very good employment. So, you know, when you're listening to some of those Hollywood classics of the 30s and 40s, the people playing in the orchestras are very often some of the finest musicians of their day, and the composers too. Erich Wolfgang Korngold, who was a child prodigy composer who drew all this attention right at the beginning of the 20th century in Vienna, and Richard Strauss and Gustav Mahler hailed him as a genius and the next Mozart and so on. You know, by the 1930s, his career was really being shoved aside by the new political reality, and Hollywood saved him in a lot of ways. And
I was hoping you'd tell that story. Erich Wolfgang Korngold, in certain ways, is the he's not the most famous figure at the center of this history, but in many ways, he pulls together more strands almost than anybody else biographically. Maybe first we should just listen to the sound of it. This is Erich Wolfgang Korngold's theme music for what happens to be Ronald Reagan's best movie, King's Row. That was the King's Row theme by the composer Erich Wolfgang Korngold. Would you talk a little bit about it, Alex?
Yeah, well, this is the classic Korngold sound, and he came to Hollywood in the 30s, and his first really successful scores were actually for Errol Flynn swashbucklers, Captain Blood, and The Adventures of Robin Hood. And then a little later, he wrote King's Row. And you know, he's using the language of the late 19th century and the very early 20th century, this rich, romantic, kind of slightly over-the-top, ebullient, leaping, vaulting sound. And he does it so masterfully. I mean, he could just spin out these themes one after another. And
you didn't say Wagnerian, but is that what you mean?
Yeah, it definitely comes out of Wagner and Strauss. And, of course, there's an irony here because at exactly the time that Wagner was being exalted by his diseased admirer Adolf Hitler as the prophet of the Third Reich, Korngold, who was Jewish, was escaping to Hollywood and finding employment there and using Wagner sounds to express the spirit of, you know, Hollywood entertainment and the high-class studio pictures. So, you know, the destinies of sounds are always very complicated, and Wagner as a influence on 20th century music was so multifarious and went in so many different directions. But Korngold, he was a fabulous composer. He ended up feeling somewhat unhappy that everyone talked about his film scores while his classical scores were neglected, and he wrote some splendid operas in his youth and big orchestral pieces. And after the war, he wrote this symphony, large-scale symphony, which was actually inspired by the death of Roosevelt, and was a sort of a tribute to Roosevelt. And it's a magnificent piece, but unfortunately in the 1950s it was considered rather out of date and was widely dismissed as a relic of a lost time. But if you forget about its chronological position and just listen to the music, especially the slow movement. This is one of the great slow movements of the symphonic literature, and it's so moving to think of Korngold, this former child prodigy turned Hollywood film composer, reaching back to his core tradition and writing this towering piece, which I think is finally creeping into the mainstream repertory after being neglected for many years.
Let's listen to the slow movement of Korngold's Symphony in F sharp. That was Korngold's Symphony in F sharp major, the Adagio. In what sense was Korngold not just a political refugee in Hollywood, but a man finding new space, new room, new ideas, a new inspiration for Wagnerian themes that may have been exhausted in the 20th century?
I think a lot of 20th century composers were no longer working with this kind of sound. And after Schoenberg and Stravinsky and the early 20th century revolutions in music, this was all old hat, and people were using a lot more dissonance, or they were experimenting with jazz sounds, or going back to the Baroque period, et cetera, et cetera. Sort of actually anything but Wagner, who was this overshadowing figure that everyone wanted to escape from, whereas Korngold was steeped in that tradition and did not wish to abandon it. And yes, he managed to make it contemporary again by finding new contexts, new dramatic contexts for this musical world in Hollywood. And he was a master of his art, and he gave this music new life. And interestingly enough, at the end of the 20th century, Romanticism came back in fashion in a lot of ways, and a lot of younger composers wanted to pick up this thread which had been cut or dropped, during the period of the World Wars. And they thought to themselves, well, why can't I write for a big, lush orchestra, at the end of the 20th century or the beginning of the 21st century? Who's telling me that I can't? And so there's been an interesting romantic revival, and with it a revival of interest in Korngold's music.
Remind me, Alex Ross, where do we hear that neo-romanticism today? The big sound, the lush heart sound.
Yeah, I mean, composers such as John Adams and John Corigliano, and Aaron J. Kernis, many others who came of age in the 1970s and 1980s after the peak of modernism and experimentation in music. And they sort of wanted to go in a different direction, and have had a great deal of popular success with works in this mode, which also mix in more modern sounds. And Osvaldo Golyov, I would say, is conscious of this tradition as well, even though I wouldn't describe him as a neo-romantic composer. He's simply an artist who wants to have every possibility available to him and at his fingertips. And I think the romantic tonal tradition is one thing that's at his disposal as he works, but he may disagree.
Alex, you beat me to the punch in naming the composer Osvaldo Golyov. He joins us in this conversation. 47 years old, born in Argentina, into a Jewish family from Eastern Europe. Osvaldo is famous for his combining of traditions, as in this Passion According to St. Mark, which adds Cuban drums and other Latin rhythms to the form of Bach's St. Matthew and St. John Passions. Let's listen. From The Passion of St. Mark by Osvaldo Golahov, that was the section Por qué. We should ask Osvaldo to speak for himself. Osvaldo Golahov, you are a child of many traditions, but in what ways, in the context of Alex Ross's book, do you see yourself as a kind of 21st century child of this 20th century?
Well, I think that I'm honored by Alex saying that sometimes it's difficult to trace the origins of a composer, and he says, well, sometimes Björk sounds classical and Osvaldo Golahov sounds popular, you know. I would perhaps place myself, as Alex just said, in the position of somebody that uses whatever sees fit to express the particular emotion or idea that I want to express at the moment. And I don't make any difference between what was formerly called low or high or east or west or, you know, or north or south. It's a whole array of means that we have today, and all of them carry expressive power, and we should use them, transform them, and recombine them.
Easy for you to say, but very few people before your generation could draw on as many places and themes as you do. And it's second nature to you in a way. You have Eastern European and Jewish history behind you. You have Argentinian, Latin ear for Cuban and Brazilian and American music. And you also have,
yes,
a kind of modernist training. So the whole palette is there. Tell us your story, Osvaldo, and how you begin to cook up the new sound.
Yes. Well, I think that the world today is different in terms of what is the concept of folk music, of folklore, than it was in the time of Bartok. Bartok used to travel from village to village and would comment on the fact that the shoes in one village were made in an absolutely different way than the shoes in a village 5 kilometers away.
Mm.
And today you are in New York or in any big city in America or Europe, or and you have this tremendous mix of cultures. I mean, my children go to school with Indian children, Brazilian children, Chinese children. So we have to admit that we all live in this world, and certain cultures have explored certain emotions in a more persistent way than others. You know, I mean, the flamenco tradition has explored desolation in a way that I don't see any other tradition, and as tango has explored sexual provocation and so forth. So I when I sit down to write, I think of tango or flamenco or Richard Strauss as countries, you know, as cultures or as composers, doesn't matter. But they are, traditions that have explored certain areas of the human soul in sound.
That's completely fascinating, but it also opens up bigger questions about what this European tradition, the Viennese tradition, actually came to and where it went in the 20th century. Are you satisfied with this, my general summing up, that it went to Hollywood?
I'm not an expert, but yes, clearly there was this, I mean, what you and Alex were just saying, this incredible influx of tremendous talent and craft going from Europe, from Central Europe to Los Angeles. And let's not forget Stravinsky himself, who had no small talent. So something big happened.
And wrote for Walt Disney before he was done, right?
Alex probably knows better, but my understanding is that he did, that Walt Disney took his music, and then he had, if I'm correct, he had another funny encounter with L.B. Mayer, where Mayer said, "Mr. Stravinsky, I want you to write the soundtrack for me, and here is your orchestrator." I don't know, Alex probably has the facts straight, but that's also the funny situation in which these geniuses were confronted with in L.A., you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-sided legacy, actually, that Vienna leaves, because, you know, on the one hand, you have Korngold using this very familiar language and bestowing it on Hollywood in a way that Hollywood embraced, and, you know, it became the standard film music sound. Mm. But then you also had these more daring figures led by Schoenberg, for whom the Viennese tradition of Mozart and Beethoven had turned into a much more complex endeavor, where themes were broken down into fragments and constantly developed and turned inside out and upside down, and the resulting music was much more difficult for mainstream audiences. So, I mean, I always think of the great story of when Schoenberg went to see Irving Thalberg at MGM, and Thalberg had heard one of Schoenberg's early works on the radio, a tonal piece, and he loved it. And at the beginning of the conversation, he said to Schoenberg, I was so pleased to hear your lovely music the other day. And Schoenberg said, I do not write lovely music. So there was a sort of a breakdown of communication between them. And it's funny, but both Schoenberg and Stravinsky really wanted to work in Hollywood, perhaps mostly for the money, but I think also for the challenge of, you know, reaching out to this big film audience with their music. And actually, in neither case did they actually succeed. Disney used Stravinsky's music in Fantasia, but Stravinsky never wrote an original score for Hollywood.
Hmm. Can I attempt a very amateur pushback on the general theme, Alex Ross? It seems to me you can picture sort of the Viennese tradition finding its way to the States and into the movie business. At the same time, it seems to me the bigger news of the 20th century is the arrival of, should we say, Afro-Caribbean music, encompassing New Orleans, encompassing Havana, encompassing Rio, I suppose. But it seems to me it starts with something almost entirely, not almost entirely new, and Gershwin and Ellington knew each other well, etc. But there's an energy, there's a politics, there's a complexion, a rhythm, there's a dance vitality, there's a both serious and popular force of it all that's quite unlike that Viennese tradition.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the big news of the 20th century, and classical music had a great deal of trouble coming to terms with it. You know, back in the 1920s, there were European composers and young American composers who were listening to jazz and trying to assimilate jazz, but not always with success, because if you sort of put it down on paper and arrange it nicely for an ensemble, you may lose the whole point of it in a way, which is that that improvisatory energy and that sense of the unexpected. So there were some not-so-successful experiments in that line, and sort of all through the 20th century, I feel that composers were struggling to come to terms with this new popular energy or rejecting it, and in a way trying to get as far away from it as possible. And part of the problem is that these were almost entirely white composers attempting to do this. There were very few African-American composers, for instance, who were really allowed into the classical establishment. And I talk about that in my book, and this absence at the heart of American music for much of the 20th century. I think now things have shifted at the beginning of the 21st century, and composers these days are much more diverse in terms of their origins. And I think, you know, one amazing, great thing that's happened in Osvaldo Golijov's music is he has found a way to capture that spontaneity in a way by notating his scores up to a point, but leaving some room for improvisation and working very closely with masters of these traditions and collaborating with them. And so, you know, while Bartok and Stravinsky and others toward the beginning of the 20th century, you know, grappled with this folk tradition and tried to seize it on paper, I think he's just gone a little bit further in terms of really falling into sympathy, into sync with these traditions, and in a way surrendering a little bit of that total control in the process. And this, the result is music where it's actually hard to name. You know, where does it go? What category does it fall into? And the magic of it is that it's elusive for someone who really wants to tie everything down and give music a name.
You say it wonderfully well. Have you heard Osvaldo's piece Azul?
Yes, yeah, I heard it last summer.
There's a wonderful coincidence here. I mean, I heard it performed last weekend at the Boston Symphony by, among others, Jamie Haddad, the percussionist, I mean, a jazz player, really, and Yo-Yo Ma, I mean, on stage in a kind of improvised, almost trading fours sort of intimacy with Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist. And it was breathtaking, Osvaldo. And it was simply glorious music, and everybody was on the edge of their seats. It was like watching a bullfight or something. Yo-Yo seemed to be high as a kite doing this. What was the idea of that sort of fusion? How was that conceived, and how did it work for you?
Yo-Yo has been exploring very, very seriously all the Silk Road music, and in the process, he's unafraid to improvise. Yeah, and actually, his part in the concerto is entirely written in terms of rhythm and notes, but he brings an incredibly new array of bowing techniques, of color, you know, and also a sense of what is called simply groove, you know. I mean, not all classical musicians know how to groove, although I have to say that the new generation is very fluent at it. And I think, you know, what is exciting is that I believe that the composers of the, you know, Bach and Beethoven definitely knew what groove was, and in the 20th century, I would say that we had to wait until Ligeti to recover this kind of periodicity, this kind of, if not physical dance, at least a cosmic dance or a dance of the mind. And I don't know. I think that Yo-Yo can. When you have a performer like him, then the orchestra gets inspired, and the whole you have like 80 people that are in a sync, in a state of sync that you usually associate with five or six people in a jazz or rock group.
Yeah, that, you say it again very beautifully. That's what it was like. At the same time, can I just say, it felt like a movie score in a certain way. The part of me was saying, I want to see the movie of this music.
You like it, and many people say the same and say, "Whoa, that's terrible, that's low," and blah blah blah. So you know, it's I don't know if it's a movie score, but definitely there are visual theatrical images. But I also see images when I hear Mahler, you know, and I don't see anything wrong with that.
Mahler, I've wondered if Mahler and Steven Spielberg were actually the same person. I mean, the Mahler Fourth Symphony and E.T.
I think when you write a concerto that is, you know, like close to half hour long, the images can be movie-like, but the narrative is propelled by the music. I don't know. I mean, I'm interested in knowing what Alex thinks. I mean, I know that there is a number of music critics that are horrified by this and dismissive of this. I don't know. I personally am happy with this.
What's the critical hang-up, Alex?
Well, it's just this phrase, "Oh, that sounds like a movie score," which always troubles me because, I mean, what are people saying, really? I mean, usually it refers to some swelling of strings and a lush texture, a rich rich texture. But this doesn't belong to the movies. It's been used by the movies, but, you know, Wagner and Mahler came first. And, you know, it would be like looking at an Eisenstein film and saying, oh, that just looks like an MTV video with all the rapid cutting and so forth. You know, that it sort of gets things in the wrong order chronologically. And, you know, I think the problem is that certain sounds have been so heavily associated with certain classic images from film that when we hear a particularly lush kind of orchestral texture, suddenly you know, Betty Davis pops up in our minds, you know, saying, I love you terribly, you know, and this and that kind of, you know, dialogue. And I think it's important to push that association, those immediate associations to the side a little bit, you know, what is the sound itself, and to sort of focus on the sound and find your own associations for it. And with Azul, I actually felt that I was moving back to the world of the later Richard Strauss a little bit, where there's this wonderful tonality that seems to come from the other side of the world, and you know, it's romantic music, but written by someone who's found this place of great isolation from the world around him. And in the same way, Sibelius, Jean Sibelius, the great Finnish composer, at the end of his life, still writing in a tonal idiom relatively familiar, but from a place of extreme loneliness and creative isolation in the best sense. And I felt moments in Azul where the same kinds of sounds were surfacing in a way that was very surprising, given how much, you know, also there is this folk influence in the music, and the energy of drumming and improvisation and sort of a collective celebration. I don't know, Osvaldo, whether you agree or not, but there is also this melancholy that I felt at passages in this remarkable score.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And it's a sense of, I mean, not Vienna melancholy, not angst ridden melancholy, but sort of a cosmic melancholy that I associate with Sibelius, and a more something that transcends the me, the ego, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, one thing that is important is one of the most important thing I think in Alex's book is, you know, when I was a student in the 70s, you know, many of the composers that Alex has acknowledged that they are major figures, such as Sibelius or Strauss, were footnotes, were obliterated from the music, from the history of the 20th century when I was a student. Were not even, you know, let alone Korngold, but Strauss, Sibelius, they were irrelevant, you know, even Shostakovich and Britten. And then you look back today, and really the picture that emerges from the 20th century is the picture that you read in The Restive Noise. There is, of course, always Schoenberg and Stravinsky, but then there is justice done with Britten, Shostakovich, Janáček, you know, these Sibelius, these composers that were oddities and suddenly are the legacy of the past century, and of course Duke Ellington as well.
I wanted to ask, what do you make as a sort of historical marker, Alex, of something like the music of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Tundun's? I mean, he has a symphonic career, and he has a Hollywood career. What does that tell you? Also that he's a Chinese musician who has made it big in New York.
You know, I think his career and also Osvaldo's career, you know, he is now taking up some film work. You know, this tells us that, you know, you no longer need to choose sides. You no longer need to strictly define yourself as, oh, I am a concert composer, or I am a film composer, or, you know, I belong to the European tradition or the American tradition. I think You know, one great thing that the 20th century tells us is that these definitions break down and reality overshadows them and shoves them to the side. And, you know, there are so many surprising conversations that took place over the course of the 20th century between George Gershwin and Alban Berg, or between, you know, the Beatles listening to Stockhausen. I mean, we just never know how a sound is going to end up, and it can travel so far in our new globalized society. So, you know, now you have Han Dun, who grew up in a very rural part of China and had no idea what classical music was when he was young. He discovers it. You know, and he discovers the avant-garde. He discovers John Cage and Stockhausen, and then a little later he starts writing in a much more romantic idiom, and now he works steadily as a film composer as well as writing concert works. All of this is so unexpected, and there's a whole wave of Chinese-born composers who have come to the fore, and many of them are now resident in America. It'll be very, very interesting to see what the next generation, I think, from China tells us, and also from South America. I mean, look at this incredible music education program in Venezuela, which has already produced one world-class conductor in Gustavo Dudamel. You know, who are the composers who are going to come out of that program? I am so eager to see what the 21st century throws at us, and it's going to be surprising. It's not going to be a mere repetition of the past.
Osvaldo, I have this sense in your own music that we're going to hear more for the rest of your life, probably, out of this Afro-Caribbean Latin treasury. Could that be?
Yes, it could be. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I really don't think so far in the future. But I'm sure that, I mean, it's a music that I love, and I'm sure that I will use it again. I don't know, but I don't think it's going to be in the primary colors kind of way that I used it in the Passion.
Interesting.
I don't know. I feel that maybe because I'm getting older or whatever, I'm more interested in other hues that are not the in-your-face thing that happened in the Passion, which, but who knows? I mean, I just don't know. But definitely it's a music that I keep coming back to as a listener, and to study and to play and to enjoy. You know, we'll see when it finds its place again, you know, in my work.
Alex's book, Osvaldo, ends on a note that, among other things that's interesting at the start of this century, is a possible convergence between somebody like you and the pop artist Björk. The notion being that that when you listen to Björk and Golohov, you can hear a certain overlap of pop and classical composition going in each other's directions. And he writes, one possible destination for 21st century music is a final great fusion. Intelligent pop artists and extroverted composers speaking more or less the same language. The extroverted composer is you, Osvaldo.
Well, I mean, Björk is a great composer, and tremendously sophisticated and aware, and with a highly refined sense of what matters in music, and she has the magic, you know. She can do something that is incredibly original and new, and at the same time find a wide audience. I mean, it's a great artist. What can I say?
Who else do you find interesting on the pop scene, Osvaldo?
I personally love Outkast very much, of the new people, but and of course the thing with pop and also with classical music, no, I mean, artists keep growing. I mean, I think that Prince keeps growing and he retains a base of audience, but he's not as popular as in the 80s, but as an artist he keeps growing. So he's a true artist, as I feel Björk is, as I feel so many, as you know, as Mozart was, and there is a moment of absolute convergence between what you do and the audience, and then and the same happened to Stravinsky. You know, he kept growing after the Firebird, and also growing bitter about the continued fame of the Firebird despite his new explorations. In any case, there are great artists that keep growing, and not necessarily their best work is what makes them most popular.
Alex Ross, give us a name or two to listen for before this decade is out.
Well, I think it's really interesting to watch what the young composers are doing now, because they've grown up with pop culture. Many of them grew up with hip hop and electronic dance music, techno, and so on, and they're very eager to incorporate that either on the surface of their music or somewhere down below, because you just don't want to be a sort of imitator and sort of, you know, want to be a pop artist that are trapped in classical music. So there's some really interesting young composers in New York right now, Nico Muhly and Judd Greenstein and Corey Dargle and many others who are playing with this kind of ambiguity, and they may do sort of pop projects on the side, or they may write straight classical pieces even for church choir and very traditional media, but you can sort of feel something below the surface. This is different. This is not a repetition of the past. So, you know, certainly this convergence is happening, but I think we're also still going to have the major distinctions between the classical tradition and pop music on the outside. And I would never want to lose those distinctions, because they are what help us hear and to make sense of different kinds of music. And, you know, you have some other young composers who are still devoted to this radical modern idea of using sounds aggressively and confrontationally, and they may have grown up with the noisier end of rock, and so, you know, so that's their popular connection. So it's very hard to predict where things are going to go. There are going to be shocks and surprises, but I'm just so eager to sit back and wait to see what happens. I shouldn't be trying to, you know, imagine it in advance, or I won't be able to hear, you know, what doesn't fit into my preconception.
Have you got a last word, Osvaldo? As to where should we go today?
I agree with Alex. I think you know, there is music for every situation in life. There is a music of collective celebration, music of great introspection, and everybody should do what they need to do at any particular moment in their lives. And the same goes for the listener, you know. Live and let live.
Thank you both. Alex Ross, I've been eating up this book with huge pleasure and enlightenment. Thank you for it. And Osvaldo, you know I love your music, and it's wonderful to hear you on Open Source.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Osvaldo and Chris.
From the song cycle Air of Osvaldo Golahov, Wahabibi. Paul McCarthy produced this conversation. Open Source is recorded at the Watson Institute at Brown University. You can subscribe to our podcast free at the iTunes Store, and then visit our website at www.radioopensource.org and join the conversation yourself. For Open Source, I'm Christopher Leiden.